Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday season and a peaceful and healthy new year. I also want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for all your support. This has been a great year for us, and I'm really excited about all the cool new things we'll be doing next year and all the great guests we already have lined up. We'll actually be dropping episode number 400 of fresh new content coming up soon on January 15th, and I never could have done this without you, so thanks. This week, the first week of January 2019, I'm taking some time off. During this time, we'll be rebroadcasting some of the most popular episodes of Everyone Loves Guitar. In addition, at the beginning of each of these shows, I'm going to give you some brief commentary about my recollection of the overall interview experience I had with whatever individual we're airing that day. Again, sincere thanks for listening and for all your support. If you ever want to get a hold of me, go to the contact tab on everyonelovesguitar.com website. I'm fairly inundated with email, to be honest with you, and with work in general. So while I may not be able to answer your specific message, I do read all the messages and comments I get. Thanks again for your support. Now let's get busy with today's show. Today's greatest hits is with Shem von Schreck. Shem is currently out with Toto as their bass player. What I remember about Shem, so this interview is a long time ago. Shem's played with Kenny Loggins, Michael McDonald, David Foster, Christopher Cross. He was out with Don Felder for a while, Stephen Stills. He played with Tom Jones. You know, Tom has an American band, or he used to only have, he'd have like a UK band and an American band. So Shem was part of the American band. He's played with Spooky Tooth, Gary Wright. I mean, he's done a ton of stuff. Things I remember about Shem is, first of all, the guy's a badass. He is jacked. He's in great shape, takes real good care of himself. I mean, I work out and I take care of myself. He blew me away, you know, and he's probably my age, maybe a year or two older or younger, but in my age range. Really into fitness, really into health. He's also, I mean, check this. He's so talented. He's an opera singer. He sings tenor opera. He's an orchestra conductor, and he's also a fiction author. And he also plays guitar. I mean, there's some videos of him. He's got a band with David Gilmour's drummer after Rick Wright, which is Steve DeStanislaw. And Shem's playing bass and guitar. I mean, he's a great guitar player as well. But his dad, if I remember correctly, was actually, I think, an arranger in New York City back in the day, and his mom was a professional singer. And Shem used to go to sessions with his dad. And from those early beginnings, his baseline standard was set at an incredibly high level. So he's a super creative person with a baseline performance of really, really high standards. So everything he does, he applies these standards to, and he's successful in all of them. But, you know, he also has had his highs and his low. He talks about some things that impacted him. I believe it was maybe hanging out with the wrong people, or he got involved with people who were potentially the wrong people. And he grew up, I think, in Jersey, but he also spent quite a bit of time on a horse ranch in Idaho. And that experience really impacted him and helped shape the person who he was, or who he became and who he is today. So really fascinating guy. I mean, is to be that, you know, let's face it, it's really hard to be excellent in one thing, but to be excellent in multiple things at a high level, man, that's a pretty talented human being. So Shem is definitely that guy. Great guy. We had good chemistry. We got along fantastic. And I think you could get the sense of that vibe during our call. Enjoy it. Check out Shem von Schreck. Let's do this. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And today we're going to show some love to the rhythm section. We've got a really, I can't even say it, amazing guest. A super cool guy who's got a really robust career and has done a lot with a lot of people, and he's multi-talented in a lot of different areas, which is unusual because You know, it's hard enough to become successful at one thing, but our guest today, Shem Von Schreck, has been successful in several different areas. So, and in spite of that, he still wanted to come on this show. So I was very grateful. So let me talk to you about Shem. Shem Von Schreck's been entertaining audiences since he was 3 years old. He's a veteran of the stage and recording studio. He's performed in all 50 states and 44 countries as a singer, a multi-instrumentalist, and a music director in a diverse range of genres. He's currently the bassist and the principal backing vocalist for the legendary band Toto, and they've already sold out a quarter of the year ahead of time for 2018, he was just telling me, for throughout Europe. In addition, he's toured and recorded with several international and Grammy Award-winning artists, including Kenny Loggins, Michael McDonald, David Foster, Christopher Cross, Richard Marx, Don Felder, Patty Austin, Stephen Stills, Tom Jones, Gary Wright, Spooky Tooth, and many others. He made his professional opera debut in Germany with the, tell me if I mess this up, Dublin Freiburg.
Dublin Freiburg.
Yeah, can you say the rest of it? Because I'm going to mess that one up.
middle. What it means, that word means that's the middle area of Saxony, Middle Saxicious.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. That's the middle Saxony, Germany. There.
Great, and he made his debut as Spoletta in Puccini's Tosca. His operatic repertoire includes Parsifal, Siegmund, Florestan, Peter Grimes, and Canio. Or Canio?
Canio.
Canio, great. He's a regular tenor soloist with the Atlanta Symphony, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Houston Symphony Orchestra, the Philly Pops, and the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. He's also conducted several Pops concerts with the Columbus Symphony, the Oklahoma Symphony, the Dallas Symphony, the Little Rock Symphony, the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, and the Boston Pops Orchestra. He's also an author, and he wrote a thriller called Ghosts of the Fathers in 2011. And from what I hear, he makes a great cheese omelet on top of that. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show, Shem. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, Craig, it's my pleasure.
Man, this is like, I've never read anything this involved from any of the last 150 people. This is, I mean, because you've specialized in successful in so many different areas.
Well, I just, my whole life has been spent in pursuit of being creative, mostly just for my own interest. If somebody wants to buy it, if somebody's interested themselves and wants to purchase it because they're liking what I'm doing, that's a bonus. But I just really enjoy being creative. If I don't have a creative project in the moment, I get depressed. I need that creative outlet. So it's important.
Do you have a so would you say you're a workaholic?
There are too many people out there that are more of a workaholic than I am. So I have a hard time identifying myself as that, because I've seen other people that really go for that. So I just like being busy.
Yeah.
I don't like not being busy.
Right. Because I always struggle with that. Like, I know what you mean, because there are guys who are like unhealthy – like it never stops. Like they're always on about that, and they can't be in the moment with anything else.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I see what you mean. Yeah. But I always think I like being busy also, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're involved in a lot of stuff yourself.
Yeah. Kind of. And I always wonder, like, when I tell myself, I just like being busy. Is that like a bullshit excuse for myself that I'm working all the time? So I don't know.
Right.
I think I'm getting better. Anyway, it's not about me, it's about you. I mentioned this earlier, and you just talked about it, how, you know, you're very interested in creative pursuits. And as I said, it's amazing that it's really hard enough to excel in one thing, but you've excelled in multiple facets of both music as a multi-instrumentalist, as a vocalist, an opera singer, a conductor, and an author. So, I know you're interested in the pursuit of creativity, but what about your background or your personality, or I think maybe even the way you look at things, has allowed you not just to accomplish these things, but to accomplish them and perform at a professional level?
I just think I was exposed to artistic talent at a high level with my parents.
Okay.
My dad is a pretty well-known arranger back in the 60s and the 70s. He did a lot of work in the New York area. He was heavily involved with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. In fact, that's his big band arrangement behind Can't Take My Eyes Off You.
Oh, wow.
That's his arrangement. So it's kind of, I always tell people that, that the arrangement's almost a little more famous than the actual song. People always remember the that's the part that I remember more than the actual song. So it's the world's most famous arrangement that didn't be involved the copyright.
That's true. So did you grow up in New York then?
A lot of my childhood was in New Jersey.
My dad
commuted into the city, so it was a New York suburb.
Very cool.
It was a great environment to be around and to get into your question. My dad was just always creating and doing music. He always had a home studio since I could remember. So he always had some projects, the songwriting. He was producing people out of that studio, so I got to see the production side of things. He would also take me into New York, into the recording sessions at a very young age. And I would see this process done and met the different musicians, people he was writing for, and even the artists. And my mom was also a great singer, and they performed a lot together. And I was always around that performance side as well. Hmm. So I just think being around art done at a high level was inspiring. It was the norm, and there was no, that was the bar, and that's what you, anything below that just wasn't acceptable.
Yeah. Now you said you had two other siblings. Are they, any of them involved in music or entertainment?
They all have musical talent. I'm the oldest of three. My brother doesn't pursue music as a career, but he was a fine drummer. He played trumpet in the high school band and could sing. He had a very good knack for melody. He was very creative as a melody writer. My sister is a brilliant musician. She was a concert violinist when she was just a little. She was playing the Tchaikovsky violin concerto, like not scraping through it, like really playing it when she was 12. Just nailing it. Didn't go into music though as a profession, but she's a phenomenal singer and just a natural gifted musician.
That's great. Did you go to high school up there, or?
Yeah, my childhood was split between New Jersey and, total contrast, Idaho, Mountain Home, Idaho, on a ranch with horses, and we live in an Air Force base town. It was really a great place to grow up with, being on a kind of a ranch setting and feeding horses every day, and it was really great. But I went to high school in the New Jersey area.
I've actually been to Idaho. It is beautiful. I mean, it's really gorgeous. Yeah.
It really is. I miss that. I miss that that life around the animals and being in that environment. I miss those smells and that atmosphere.
And the weather is pretty darn perfect too, man. I mean, in the summertime, it's like you're not boiling, you're not sweating. It's really cool.
Nice and dry. It's really great. It was a great childhood. I have no complaints there.
That's awesome, man. In each area, so you have, playing instruments, singing. Okay, you have singing, playing instruments, singing as a background vocalist, singing as an opera singer, conducting, and then writing. Does each one of those disciplines fill you up differently, or like tweak your emotions differently?
The approach to each of them, I think, is just you just put, give all of yourself to it. So you're going in to each of those situations, giving all of yourself. So emotionally, you're prepared. You're ready for that. The most exhilarating of all those is the opera singing.
Okay, interesting.
And the human voice is a very powerful thing. And I don't mean just power as far as sound, but it's an empowering human thing. Hmm. And in the opera world, there's no amplification. You're not listening to your voice through a monitoring system going into your ear monitors or through wedges or whatever your monitor situation is. There is no monitor situation. It's completely natural sound. And the training, part of the training is how to be able to monitor yourself inside your head singing into a hall where the sound is, as far as you're hearing it, it's disappearing into this massive facility with a large crowd. You might think you sound like a duck in your head, but what's going out into the house is a completely different sound, and what the audience is hearing 20 rows back is completely different than what you're hearing. And, you know, we're spoiled with the technology today. As pop singers, we hear ourselves very close to our, as the sound leaves, that we're hearing it sent right back to our ears.
Sure.
But in opera and on stage, it's going out into a hall with no amplification. It's completely natural sound. The reward of a successful performance, when it's really all you, that's an amazing, amazing feeling. It's very naked.
Yeah. Very
artistically, emotionally, very naked moment.
Yeah, there's no instruments. There's no other guys.
No, I mean, the instruments are beneath the stage or in the orchestra pit. So you're having to compete with how loud 80 pieces is. And you're just having to throw it out there and with the training and the skills to be able to make that work and acoustically survive.
So how do you, what is the train like? How do you know? Is it, do you take, is there classes or just listening to other, how do you modulate that?
You get with instruction to learn the tools. There's tricks of the trade. How to make the voice project. And it's not because you sing any louder. It's where to place the voice in the face, as the face, the industry term is in the mask, mm-hmm. because it's really the sound resonating off your skull, which is what is translating into the hall. And how to make that send the voice to the right place in the mask so that it resonates and acoustically is shot out into the hall.
Wow. You know? So let's talk about that for 1 second. So you've soloed Atlanta, Cleveland, Houston, Philly, Jacksonville. How do these guys find out about you? Like, or is it open tryouts? Or, you know, I mean, like, you know, most musicians, and you're like way past this, but, you know, have a hard time getting gigs. But here you're doing like I'm going to say side hustle in the broadest of terms, because this is a lot more than a hustle. But you know what I'm saying? And here you are, you're like booked all over the country.
Well, the people that do the hiring and want to that collect talent to do these types of things is usually the conductor. Hmm. If you get in with a certain group or a list of conductors, they will want to work with you, and if it's a success, they'll continue to call you.
Okay.
So I was fortunate. It's in this business, it's just all luck. It's all time and place. It's all being in the right place at the right time.
I don't know. I think you got to. I don't know about all luck.
You have to be able to execute.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Once the opportunities come your way. But case in point, I was music director for Kenny Loggins, and we were playing with the Houston Symphony. And the way those symphony shows would work would be the first half of the show before intermission is the symphony with a pops conductor doing whatever theme it was. Maybe it was a medley of Broadway songs or movie themes. And then the second half of the show was Kenny Loggins' time where I would conduct the symphony. And in this particular case, the conductor that conducted the first half saw my resume, saw that I had done some opera things, and he wanted to put together some shows where he was doing pops concerts with various symphonies around the country. And he wanted to collaborate, put together some shows, which we did. And that's how a lot of these orchestras found up on my resume through him and some other contacts and some other conductors hear about that, and they start to call you. The symphony community is very small as far as they all talk to each other, or they're at least got their eyes, like the Cleveland Orchestra, their pops program has their eye on what's going on in Columbus, or what's going on in Little Rock, Arkansas, what's going on in Jacksonville, Florida Symphony.
Okay.
And if like, ooh, if that show's successful there, we want that for our next season or at the end of the season.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And these things just build, you know? So that one moment of good luck, good fortune of meeting a conductor, them liking you, one good successful first performance leads to several.
Totally get it. Kind of like how you're a studio musician, you get hooked up with the right producer, you can get on loads and loads of records.
Exactly right. Yeah. That's a great example.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Thank you for explaining that. I was totally like miffed at that. I mean, impressed. I was like, holy crap, this dude's like, I'm a marketing guy, but I was thinking I got to take lessons from you. What the hell are you
doing? Oh, I'll be talking to you about some marketing things. I could use some advice there.
What the hell are you doing? So you've played with some really, you know, some great talented artists. And I was wondering for each of these guys that we'll talk about, if you could tell me how you got the gig. And either the best part of your experience or maybe something that you learned or a takeaway, good, bad, or ugly, you know.
Sure.
Not
sure.
Everything's a bed of roses. So let's talk about Toto first.
Okay. First of all, just on a personal note, Toto was always a favorite band. I mean, it's just it's a band of very well-known and seasoned musicians. It's a fraternity of guys that at a very young age took the LA session scene by storm. And this was what we all aspired to do. And all of my peers and my friends, musicians that I was living around in LA, we all wanted to be in Toto, but we knew we never would. So we formed our own bands to sound like them and write tunes like them and do things. On a personal note, to be involved in that band is just a thrill and an honor. I had met Steve Picaro, who's one of the keyboard players. I met him in the early 90s. And at the time, I was in L.A. doing one of the side projects I was doing just for fun was I was in a Police cover band, tribute band, and I was playing bass and singing all the Sting things. And he used to come out and see that quite a bit. So he knew that I could play bass and I had the high vocal range and could do that sort of thing. So cut to last year or a year and a half ago, Steve had called me and asked me if I would be interested if the bass chair in Toto was available, because they were going to make the bass chair a prerequisite was that the bass player had to sing and sing all the high background parts, because in the past bass players had never been vocalists in Toto. So they were looking for someone, and I went to an informal audition at Steve Picaro's house with all the guys, met all the guys, we played, sang. And they offered me the gig on the spot. And they said, we'll see you in 6 months when the tour starts. And that was it.
Cool. Had you known any of the other guys in the band?
I'd met them. In fact, a side story was David Page, the keyboard player and one of the main songwriters. He came to a Don Felder show that was in L.A. And he came backstage before the band went on stage and we were doing vocal warm-ups. And he heard me singing all the high parts, and he went, I need your number. I need to get your phone number. And I wasn't able to get him my phone number at the time, but he remembered that moment. So when I was referred, he was like, I know that guy.
Awesome.
And things kind of came together. See, it's all luck. It's all,
you know what I think a lot of it is? This is my two cents. I just get this from observing consulting. I've consulted probably 300 clients in the last 18 years, okay, in various marketing capacities. And it's interesting because, and I've published like information products and I've bought tons of information products. And it's interesting because sometimes you'll buy something or prescribe something for somebody and it'll be like gangbusters. Holy shit, this is what I was missing. And other times you're like, it just doesn't work. And it's because that's not what you needed. And in observing all this, and I'm a hardcore New Yorker, but my conclusion on this is very like California-ish, at least an East Coast perception. I think a lot of this is serendipity. I think if you're in the right place, I think the universe is going to either support what you're doing, if it's like if you're in the right place for you, or it's not going to support it. That doesn't mean you won't succeed, but it means you've got to really kill yourself a lot more than if you're in the right place and the universe is supporting it. That's just a ridiculous, as I'm saying it, I know how ridiculous it sounds because there's no logic, but it.
Perhaps I should supplant the word luck with serendipitous.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we're basically saying the same thing, because those paths cross and it's that serendipitous union of two paths crossing. And,
right.
You know, so.
Yeah, what are the chances that you get called? The guy happened to come backstage and hear you prepping. You know, if he came backstage 10 minutes later, he might not have even heard that.
Right.
Yeah, it's always amazing when you look back. Well, that's a great story, man, and I'm glad you got the gig, and I'm glad
And it's been great. It's been a blast. These guys have been so welcoming to me in their family. And they say, hey, once you're in, you'll never get out.
Great.
Because they're very loyal. You know, they're very, you know, once you're in, they want you part of the family. They don't want to have to go looking for somebody else when somebody works out.
That's great. And I know your work ethic is second to none. So, you know.
I went into those first rehearsals last year for my first tour with them over prepared. I mean, it was so, you know, I'm always very prepared when I go into any situation like that.
Yeah, well, you can't accomplish all this like haphazard, like, you know, I took a shot and it worked. You know, I mean, this is like, right. You know.
Well, it's like I said at the beginning, you know, I was taught the work ethic by my parents. I was shown that, like I said, I used the word, there was a bar that you just don't go under that. You don't ever go into a situation unprepared. What's wrong with you?
No, I'm totally with you 100%. It's just, it's your confidence is higher. Your performance is better. There's no reason not to.
Everything. Mm-hmm.
So talk about Kenny Loggins.
Again, was always a huge fan of his writing and his voice, and had all his records growing up. And he was a huge inspiration to me as a singer, as a vocalist.
Great voice, yeah.
And the guitar player that I played in that Police tribute band, his name is John DeFaria. He wrote Gloria Estefan's "Get on Your Feet." He was in Miami Sound Machine for a while.
Sure.
He got a call to be a guitar playing sub for Kenny on a couple of shows, and in passing, Kenny mentioned to a group of guys there, John being one of them, that he was going to be needing a singing bass player to sub for his guy who's going to be taking a few months off. And John said, I know the guy. You should check him out.
Boom.
And first thing Kenny said, is he black? Because he was looking for a black bass player to replace the black bass player he had at the time.
Right.
Great
right.
bass player, Freddie Washington, legendary bass player. That was Kenny's first, I remember John telling me that. And he's like, no, he's not. But I think if you give him a shot, I think he'll, you know, might work out for you. And then long story short, I went up, drove up to Kenny's house in Santa Barbara, sat across from him with just playing guitars and bass and singing. And 6 days later, I was doing a live TV show with him in New York City.
Awesome. That's great, man.
Remember the old Sue Simmons Live at 5?
I do. I grew up listening to Sue Simmons as a kid.
And Matt Lauer was the roving reporter at the time
who
interviewed Kenny.
That's right.
Matt Lauer before he was Matt Lauer.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Sue Simmons. She retired like not too long, a few years ago. I saw something on Facebook or something.
Yeah.
And she was like, that was a big deal because she was the first like black anchor woman in New York.
She was great. She was legendary. She was the face of that network locally.
Yeah. Yeah, she was great. It was her and like Chuck Scarborough or something.
Right.
I'm digging way back in the memory banks.
Yep, yep.
Michael McDonald.
Michael McDonald, that was an association with Kenny Loggins. Mike and Kenny would do a lot of co-bills together since they'd written so many songs together and they could sit in on each other's sets. And it was just Michael seeing me with Kenny and just did things together. Once that happened, I made that connection there.
Hmm. What was it like working for both of those guys? Or I shouldn't say working with both of those guys.
They're both very different. Kenny's more of an alpha personality as far as he's very controlling, he's very intimate with his arrangements and he's constantly making changes and he's very particular. Mike is much more passive, much more easygoing. You know, he's clear about what he wants, but he's a much more lighthearted individual.
Hmm.
And I mean, here's a guy who has very little ego and he doesn't take himself seriously at all. He's just, without his striking ice blue eyes and his white gray hair.
Yeah.
Just meeting a guy like that, you'd never know he was a, you know, very successful Grammy Award winning artist. He's one of the most down to earth artists you'll ever be around.
That's great.
Yeah.
Was that a takeaway? I mean, you're definitely not a guy with an ego at all. I mean, and I mean that in a very, very good way. But was that something that was like maybe a takeaway from him or?
Oh, I'm not sure what you mean.
Like, is there anything like any takeaways you got from working with either of those guys, like lessons learned or even musical lessons learned, something that was like, you know, put that feather in my cap and I'll keep that in my memory?
because Kenny is constantly changing arrangements and keeping you on your toes. I mean, he'll go so far as when you're in soundcheck and saying, oh, for that second verse and that second chorus of that song, I want you guys to switch harmony parts, but just for that second chorus.
Wow.
And you got to remember that. But he gets guys around him that can do that.
Okay.
You know, and so you got to be sharp. So that's definitely a gig that's going to make you better because it's challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, you're rolling your eyes every time he makes an arrangement change. Like, really? But take, like you said, what do you take away from it? It makes you better. It makes you have to be more more special forces on stage.
Yeah.
You know, you're definitely in the trenches and anything can happen at any time. It makes you better.
Well, and you're, like, I'm sure you're very detail-oriented, so none of that stuff probably ever slipped by. I could just see you being like, I mean, you can't do what you've done, like I said, haphazardly. You gotta be on top of your shit, you know, A to Z, and, you know, you can't.
At that level, yeah, you do, yeah. but it's just what you do. That's what I know. That's how I was raised.
Hmm, sure.
Yeah.
How about working with Don Felder from the Eagles? Or am I allowed to say that formally with the Eagles?
Against the Eagles camp, you have to say that.
Okay, Don Felder formerly with the Eagles.
they will they will demand that. Don's an easygoing guy. He's outwardly real passive. He's not real demanding. He hates to rehearse. I think I can count in the 11 years I've been with him, almost 12. I think I can count 6 hours total of rehearsal.
Wow. In 12 years.
Yeah.
Well, that says a hell of 12 years. That's like, you know, in musician world, like 150 years. No. No, I mean, seriously,
you could totally say that.
Yeah.
But here's the complete contrast. We're talking about Kenny before. The arrangements have been the same with no changes in 12 years. So there's no real reason to rehearse.
Right.
The song list has been pretty much the same throughout. The arrangements have been the same. So you just go on stage. You're kind of on autopilot at that point. And that the challenging part I mentioned with Kenny, it isn't there with Don. With Don, you know, with anything, you have to execute. I get to sing some lead vocals with Don.
That's great.
I sing Take It to the Limit in Don's show.
Because I think who...
That was Randy Meisner.
Randy Meisner. I was thinking Timothy, but no, it's a different one. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So
it's a beautiful song. That's a really beautiful song.
Great, great song.
Yeah.
Great song. So yeah, so every artist has their own dynamic. They also have their own organization thing, how they like to travel, how they like to what's the protocol for when you get a call time to get to the bus or get to the lobby to go to soundcheck. Kenny, if it says 5 o'clock, it's 5 o'clock. With Don, if it says 5 o'clock, if you're not there at 4:50, you're late.
Right. Yeah. No, I hear that. I hear that.
You know,
a lot.
Everybody, so they're all different.
Yeah.
It's a different dynamic. But you have to, as a professional, you know, get your game on and just adapt to those different situations.
Sure. Sure. What was Stephen Stills? You know, he's one of my favorite guitar players, and creative, talk about creative forces, man.
I met Stephen through Don. I made that connection through Don. One of the first things I did with Don was a Hurricane Katrina benefit. It was a relief concert, and so that's where I met David Foster, and it was just Don Felder and Friends was the name of that show. How it was built, and Stephen was part of it, and Stephen had just come out with an album, a blues album, and he heard me play bass and wanted me to play some things with him.
Did you do any of his old stuff, like Black Queen, or, you know, stuff from back in the day?
We didn't do that. It was just mostly this new album that he was promoting.
I haven't heard any of his new stuff, but man, I have some of his old stuff.
This would be new in like 2006.
Okay. Yeah. What was it like, or what was the dynamic there?
Stephen, you're not sure which Stephen's going to walk in the room. each hour of the day, we're really not sure which Stephen is going to show up.
Yeah.
and he's got this body language where you think he's totally pissed off at you, and yet he's thinking what you're playing is great.
Oh, really?
You know, I know there's no visual here for the the listeners, but he can, he kind of has this like abominable snowman yeti type move that he does on stage, and you think he's like yelling at the top of his lungs saying that what you're playing is horrible. Really, he's going, he's giving you a thumbs up.
Oh, that, so it takes a while to figure that out, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my God, this guy hates me right now. And no, he was liking it.
That's so funny, man. That is real funny. Did you do any like CSN stuff, or was all his?
No, I was just, it was just guest work with him as a guest with Don.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And I was, you know, it wasn't like I didn't go on an actual tour with Stephen.
He just joined. It was,
correct.
Yeah, okay, I get you. How about Tom Jones? My mother-in-law loves that guy because my wife's from the UK, so I think her mom actually saw him. She was probably one of those ladies throwing panties at Tom like in the 60s or whatever. I don't know. Right. But he's a great performer, man.
He's I really enjoyed that year. It was just 1 year. I just did all of 98. When I say all of 98, I'm talking from January 1st to New Year's Eve with Tom. And it was a lot of fun. We got to go to a lot of places. He did 230 shows that year. And there's only 365 days in a year, so just think about that.
So that's close to, you know, 280 total with travel and oh wow.
Yeah, exactly. So
was it a world tour?
Yes. It's always a world tour with Tom. He's always He's always everywhere. And he's doesn't like to be home. He likes to be on the road. That's his favorite thing to be, is out there singing and traveling. He loves it.
Good God, if I was Tom Jones, it'd be my favorite thing to do.
Now that's probably of all the great singers I've worked with, it's the most powerful voice I've ever heard. It's monstrous. If you're standing within 5 feet, you're gonna have like burns on your face.
Really? It's that powerful?
It's, yeah.
And he's in great shape. I mean, I've seen him. Does he like work out or something? Or I mean he's Or is it just good genetics?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's that Welsh coal mining genetics of his, whatever that means.
Yeah.
He's that. He's a powerhouse.
Yeah. That's fantastic. That's
really he's a genuinely happy man. He's a happy man.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Spooky Tooth, you know, when I saw that name, they're in my rotation, but I don't have a big catalog of them, but whatever I listen to, it's, you know, it takes you back to the like late 60s. It's pretty cool. How did that come about?
Well, I've known Gary Wright for 20 years. I was in the band Ambrosia for a while.
Oh, okay.
And Ambrosia was doing some things with some guest artists like John Ford Coley and Stephen Bishop and Edgar Winter and, Gary would come up and do some of his songs, and just developed a relationship with him, did some tours with Gary as the artist, and when he was going to put Spooky Tooth back together in the after the millennium, he called me and did mostly Germany. Germany is where Spooky Tooth has had the biggest fan base.
Really? Isn't it interesting? Because, like you said, Toto's big over in Europe and certain places in Scandinavia, and Spooky Tooth in Germany. Is there any rhyme or reason for any of that?
Not to insult the American audience, but they're kind of fickle.
No,
they if as opposed to the European audience, when something is really hot here. Sometimes that one-hit wonder thing is gone in 6 months, never to be seen again. The Spice Girls were the biggest thing ever, and then they're gone. Ricky Martin was off the charts, huge, gone.
Hmm.
You know, and their fame will never be what it was. European audiences, if you reach a certain level of fame and it's respected, they'll stick with you.
Hmm.
They don't go in like a bin of records or CDs. excuse me, that they'll never pull out again. It stays in their rotation, in emotionally, in their heads, and in the way they listen to music. And I think their radio stations are the same that way.
So they're reflective of, they're not always churning and burning, they're playing like tried and true stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the same with the Japanese and the South American audiences as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not surprised at that, because it seems like well, I mean, just go, if you get back to marketing, one of the, if something's new, if you put a new spin on it, that's how it sells. Not like, hey, we've got this old thing back that worked 40 years ago. Nobody's interested. You know, yeah, I don't know why that is, but that's interesting.
It's the novelty of something new wears off here. It's isn't that where the French word nouveau comes from?
Yeah. Right?
Novelty. People get bored easily here.
Well, I think because they can. They've trained business. You know, consumers have trained businesses that, hey, what have you done for me yesterday? You know, what's your new shtick? That's what I want. It's really weird, though.
You're only as good as your last 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I interviewed a guy in Nashville. His name is Jerry McPherson. I don't know if you know Jerry. He's
absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
So Jerry's been a First Call guy for 25 years. Okay. And
deservedly,
he's a great guy. I mean, he's just a cool dude. And we talked about this, and he said, you know, when I buy an album, or I'm giving it somebody I don't know, I'm going to give them the whole album's worth to see if we could have a musical relationship. You know, I'm not expecting to like every song, but I'm hoping there's two or three nuggets in there that I'll really dig. Right. You know, the last song on side one, I'm dating myself, but right. The last song on side two, the next to last song, maybe on side two or side one also. So he said, it's not like that now. He said, not only do they not give you an album, he goes, you don't even have till the chorus in an individual song. He said, it's like, man, if it's like going to New Orleans, like show me your tits. You know, if you don't get it out real quick, like really quick, you're done.
Yeah. And it's becoming an expectation.
Yeah.
And it's killing creativity.
Well, I think that's why, like, you hear a lot of people saying, well, how come there's no more bands like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin? Because they're not showing you their cards in the first 30 seconds. They're building up.
And dude, where are the guitar solos?
Right.
Okay, this is a guitar site, right?
Right.
Where are the guitar solos in today's modern music?
They're not.
Where are the people that are inspiring young kids to be guitarists or just musicians in general? It's just this programmed mix of sound, and nobody's really impressing anyone with their flash, inspiring kids to want to pursue that. They may want to pursue the fame, but where's the pursuit of the artistry?
Right.
There's a difference.
Yes, I agree with you. And you look at a guitarist like, let's say, a David Gilmour. That guy could say so much. He's like the most, for me anyway, the most economical guitarist, right? He really means something to me. I remember listening to him as a kid, and like he like helped me through my teenage angst, you know, because he made me feel a sense of optimism for the future.
Yeah, he makes you smile.
And like, you know, I know tomorrow's going to be better, you know?
Where is that today?
Yeah, that's hard to find.
Yeah.
It's very hard to find. And I don't know where it is. And so I always think, man, I guess I'm a dinosaur. But, you know, I just don't see it.
No.
You know?
That's true.
That's our next project, Shim.
All right.
So tell me what you're working on now that you're most excited about, because you got a million things going on.
Well, how about a great tie-in? You just mentioned David Gilmour. One of my best friends, a drummer friend of mine, Steve DeStanislaw, who is David Gilmour.
Yeah!
Yeah. He and I have a band project called The Apex, just the two of us.
Holy crap.
And we have an EP that's available on iTunes called The Apex, and it's three songs, and it's available. On my website, there's an embedded video, or a music video from one of those songs. And we have a lot of fun projects.
And it's just the bass and drums, or are you playing multi-instruments?
Well, I'm playing bass and guitars. He's playing drums, and we're both singing vocals.
That's awesome. So everybody go to Shemworks, SHEMWORKS.com, and it's on there. Look for The Apex.
Correct. Yeah, that's one of the pages. It's a page devoted exclusively to the band. And it's a fun project. And we're just going to release songs as we do them. You know, He lives in L.A. I'm in Phoenix most of the time, and we just send each other tracks. We work on stuff together. Sometimes we'll go out to his place, and next thing you know, we got a song, and we'll put it out.
That's cool, man.
How did
this come about?
The band project or our relationship?
Both.
He had auditioned for Loggins Messina back in 2005. I had played with him years ago in like early 90s and remembered his playing being great. He won the audition and we did a – we toured together for – we've been touring together ever since is really the story. And we realized we liked a lot of the same music. I started on drums, so I'm a drummer first above everything else. I just don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And
you're like the utility, entire rhythm section utility, man.
Well, I've always played drums on all my own original projects. And this is the first time I've collaborated with someone who's a great drummer just because we come from the same school of thought musically. We liked a lot of the same bands. We're both Police freaks and, you know, Stuart Copeland freaks. Just love that stuff.
Talk about a drummer, man.
Oh, yeah. I think he's the most influential drummer into our modern times. I think kids hear their favorite drummers today, not knowing that those guys were influenced by Stewart.
Oh, brilliant guy.
Just my own theory. But there was a guitar player that was in the band. We were doing a Kenny Loggins tour. It was a Christmas tour. And the guitar player, Chris Rodriguez, great guy. It was going to be a power trio with vocals and our own thing. And he just got too busy. He was with Keith Urban at the time. And I just started writing these tunes and playing all the guitars in the demos just to share with the guys. And those guitar tracks just wound up being the guitar tracks because they were fine. And Steve and I just said, let's just make it a power duo, if you will.
And so you must be a pretty darn good guitar player, man, to be laying down tracks with a guy who's played with Gilmore. And he's like, yeah, we don't need anybody else. I mean,
I can get by. I can get by. But, you know, I stand in awe of, you know, guys like Chris Rodriguez I just met and friends of mine that are just brilliant guitarists, not to mention Steve Lukather.
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest of all time.
Sure, sure.
You know, so. No, I can get by on a guitar, but I'd rather hear someone else play the parts.
That's fantastic. That sounds like a cool project. Again, everybody, check it out. It's The Apex, and it's on iTunes, or you can go to Shem's website, which is Shem, shemworks.com, WRKS. So you're originally from Jersey?
My parents were both born and raised in New Jersey. So I spent a lot of my childhood there, but I also spent it in Idaho, living on a ranch farm and horses and animals. And that was a great, great place to grow up. That was up to the age of 10. So good formative years were spent in Idaho.
So at what point, so you're going to all these, I bet you the other thing you learned subconsciously that you probably never really had to give it much thought to was like behavior etiquette. Like you learned how to behave in a professional entertainment music setting by, you know, just being around there and watching. Nobody had to sit down and say, hey, don't do this, do this, which probably helped you a lot.
Going to those early recording sessions with my dad as a toddler, like 3 and 4 years old, and him allowing me to sit in not the control room, but in the studio with him, and he'd say, see the red light? And that goes on, don't you say a word, because you're going to ruin the take and it's going to screw everything up. So I learned the etiquette by necessity.
Yeah.
Right there. So, yeah, I mean, I've never been a rebel or a bad kid. I know how to follow the rules.
Yeah.
And you just learn what to do, what not to do. Half of the success of being a touring musician is the fact that you call somebody a good hang.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, if that person isn't a good hang, it really sucks.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the gig is 2 hours out of the night, but the rest of the 22 hours a day, you're living together on a submarine with wheels. Okay. Yeah. It's a tour bus that's just, you know, it's like submarine etiquette. You got to be responsible. You got to put your stuff away. There's not a lot of space.
Hmm.
So you got to learn how to behave. You got to be liked.
Yeah.
And you got to be a person that people want to have around for 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, that's the part nobody gets to see, but it's important. If there's a rotten apple in the bunch, it spoils the whole, what's supposed to be a good vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Does that happen often, or does it happen?
I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've been around it, and it's hard. It can be difficult. It can ruin what should be a pleasant experience.
Yeah. Hmm. So at what point in time did you start playing instruments? You started playing drums first, or because of guitar, or
My dad tells a story that I was playing when I was 18 months. I don't remember. But he's like, you used to climb up on the drum stool and pick up the sticks and just start playing in time with whatever song was playing. And it's just, you know, it's got to be some DNA, but it's just, I was in an environment where it was just around. It was being done. That's the best education.
Yeah, but you had to have a propensity for it, too. You don't just sit down and do, I mean, there's people, I mean, you know, you have to have a natural aptitude as well. It sounds
yes.
Like.
Yeah,
which is great, I mean, and there's no, you know, that's not being like braggadocio. It's like it is what it is. You know, it's like, you know.
Well, I had the advantage of having, you know, sure, two talented parents.
So when did you know though, like, okay, this is what I want to do for a living, or did you not even have that thought process? Was it always like, okay, of course I'm, you know, this is what we do here in this family?
More of the latter.
Yeah.
I excelled early, and it just was, I enjoyed it. It was the family business.
And you kept pushing to do more and more because that just drove you.
Well, I was in New York City in the mid to late 80s, working in recording studios, working for a jingle house, recording music for TV and radio commercials. And I was the principal writer and one of the producers at this, call it a music agency firm that just did that. And
was that in Midtown? Was that where they had all those studios?
25th and Lexington.
Oh, man, I went to school in 23rd and Lex. I know exactly where that is.
Okay, yeah. So it was, I was doing well, but I knew I wanted to go west. So I took a big risk and left what was, you know, what was lucrative and went out west to pursue my own thing. Mostly, I really wanted to be recognized and, you know, famous for my own music and be the artist, the household name. But I quickly learned that wasn't me. And I'm fortunate in a way that I don't think I got to that place because, well, it's a challenging thing if you're not prepared for it.
Well, the other thing is, I think to be in that place, there's an extrinsic factor that has to drive you, like, and it's ego. And I'm not saying guys who are there, is anything wrong with having a big ego, but you cannot get there if you don't have a big ego.
I agree with that.
You know, because it has to be really important to you that other people give you that approval.
Yes.
And if it's not important to you, it's going to be, you're putting a square peg in a round hole.
I agree with you. And I know you're approaching that from multifaceted industries. You know, you're seeing it in a lot of, you know, different in marketing, and you're trying to help people get, you know, market their thing to their best. And you're also dealing with personalities. A lot of times people are selling themselves more than their product.
Right.
You know, I know what you're saying.
Well, I saw that myself because I was like a budding marketing guru, and I never got to that next level. And I'm okay. I wasn't willing to do the things you had to do that. I wasn't willing to go on Facebook every day and like post deep, thoughtful quotes like I got my shit together and no, you know. Well, I mean, seriously, but there's a certain template, and I'm not criticizing. I'm not saying I'm better than anybody because I am certainly not. I'm just like an average Joe dude doing my thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain template, and it's the same in any business, whether it's marketing online guru or rock star guru. There's a certain template, and you have to follow it. And if you can't, you're not going to get there.
Yeah. You're right.
You know, I mean, that was my experience anyway, you know, and I just wasn't willing to get to that next rock star level and, you know, make videos of me, you know, eating lunch somewhere. I don't want to do that.
I saw when I first joined Kenny Loggins' organization, he was still a pretty big star. And I saw what he was having to deal with. I saw him getting pulled this way and pulled that way. And just all you got to do is interview in 10 minutes and all you got to do hair and makeup for this thing or whatever it was. And I just went, wow. I might go a little nuts if that were me.
You just have to have a lot of public exposure. And if you like that and like, you know, Again, it's a big ego-driven business, and I don't mean that negatively against anybody listening to this. You know, God bless you. I'm happy you put the work in, and it was for you. It just wasn't for me, and I knew that.
Yeah.
You know,
I think I could handle it. I think I could handle it now if it came my way.
Hmm.
I think I'm emotionally prepared for it. I've seen the road. You know, I'll give you an example. I was hiking this morning, and I was with an NFL player, this buddy of mine, and this is a guy who's 26 years old and he's in super shape, right? I beat him to the top of the mountain today only because he'd never done this course before.
Okay.
He'd never done this trail, so he didn't know what was coming next. And I've done this trail several times now. He's in 10 times the shape I am.
Right.
But mentally, he wasn't prepared for the challenging course.
Right.
I said, when we do this next week, you're going to kick my butt. Because now you're mentally prepared to do it. But it's the point I'm making, you know, at the age that I am.
Yeah, yeah.
If that kind of fame or something fell in my lap that way, I think I'd be able to handle it. But back then, my instinct said, I don't know if I could handle all that I see going on here.
Are you someone that usually listens to your gut?
I do.
Yeah.
And I learned to trust my gut much more over the years.
Yeah, I am as well.
Yeah.
That being said, I worked at it for a long time and was killing myself until I finally realized, look, this ain't going to happen because it's just I'm trying to put that square peg in it. I'm not willing. I'm doing 50% of the formula. I'm not doing the other 50, and I just can't do it.
Right.
I totally get it, man. So everybody, you know, we all pay tuition in our careers, and I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes you made along your journey and what the lessons you learned from these mistakes in any endeavor. I mean, you've done so much, whatever comes to mind first would be fine.
Well, that's a great tie into what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
I hit some bumps in the road. I got involved with some of the wrong people when I first moved to LA, and in those associations, kind of took me down just down a road where I was screwed over. Let's just say I'm not going to go into the details of the actual situation, but I saw what evil was for the first time.
Really,
you know, my childhood was, you know, I had good parents. They're very loving. They're great teachers, and I'd never really experienced crisis before. Challenges, yes, but crisis. And to be the target of other people's malicious behavior, and I didn't know how to handle it, and it knocked me for a loop.
How old were you at the time?
26, 27, and I didn't trust my own judgment for quite a while, and I kind of went into hiding because I didn't trust my decision making because I'd made some bad decisions. To have allowed myself to fall into some of these traps. And one of the first things I did was I sought help. I wanted to understand what was it about me or what was lacking in me or what did I possess that drove me to be attracted to things that weren't good for me. And I'm not talking drugs here. It wasn't anything like substance abuse or anything like that. I've never had those issues. But it was getting involved with the wrong people. And after I figured some of those things out, learned some lessons, and learned why, or at least made sense to me as to why I'd made some of those decisions that took me down that path, I started to trust myself again. And of course, you don't like going through it, but I'm so glad I did.
Yeah,
because it helped make me the professional I am today, and I consider myself a pretty balanced human being. And that was very helpful. I'm glad I went through it.
I think it's a normal thing when you like get the rug pulled out from underneath you to not. I think if you're introspective and you get the rug pulled out from underneath you, it's a normal reaction because I've had some similar things happen to me, and I always, and it sounds like you did the same thing. When something bad happens, I always look at me and I hate to sit and say, oh, look what happened. You know, I like to find out what my role was in this because I'm not a victim.
That's the word I was going to just say. Was, you know, don't want to be or consider myself a victim. And for some time, I was looking at myself as a victim, going, you know, why did these people do this to me? Why did this happen? And I realized, hey, man, you allowed it to happen.
Yeah.
So that's the part you need to figure out. You can't control other people's behavior. You can only control your own. So let's do the work and find out, you know, what you can do to improve. And life's always trying to teach you a lesson.
Yeah,
you know? It's up to us to pay attention. And that's what I would have probably would now tell a younger version of me, you know, is that I would say life's always trying to teach you a lesson every second of the day, but it's up to you, young Shem, to pay attention.
Yeah.
That's your responsibility, you know. But what's that great phrase? It's, you know, youth is such a marvelous thing. Too bad it's wasted
on the young. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant, brilliant phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely do that. I like to figure out what my role is. You don't feel like a victim. And then also you could figure out, okay, how can I make sure this shit doesn't happen moving forward?
That's it.
It's like an empowering thing. You know, yeah, you feel like you have to allow yourself to feel like shit because, yeah, I made some stupid decisions and fine, you know, but.
Yeah,
it allows you to fix it easier, man. I've tried to teach my kids that, actually.
That's good.
Well, I think that's important to – if you go through life feeling powerless, God, how can you accomplish anything? I mean, life's tough enough when you have some power, right? But if you feel like you're like got no control, you're going to just get blown away like a bottle in the ocean.
And to bring up that word victim, if you can continually see yourself as a victim, that's always a view backwards.
100%.
If you consider yourself a victim, you're always looking behind, going why, you know, to get rid of that and to go introspectively and try to learn from your mistakes, that forces you to look forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. And looking in the rearview mirror has never been a smart, good, there's nothing to be gained from doing that, you know, it's always bad. I had a question here. Besides bass, what other instruments have you played professionally? But I should say, what other instruments have you not played professionally?
I don't play trombone.
Nope,
I'm not good at trombone at all.
Oh, no. I'm looking for a bass player with a high voice, plays drums and clarinet.
I did play clarinet when I was
there. You go. Growing up.
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed that too. Piano is also an instrument I'm pretty proficient on. I've been playing. Been playing piano longer than I've been playing bass, and I can get around the keyboard pretty well, and I know my theory pretty well. So, you know, I'm educated where I'm not just, you know, playing keys on the piano. My dexterity is good, and I can get around the keyboard pretty well.
This probably helped you a lot in composition. All these.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
Big time.
Because you could have a vision right away when you write something. You know where the keys are slotted in, what the bass is doing, what the fills and the guitar are going to look like, when the solo is going to go. Yeah, that's really cool, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the piano.
A really cool thing. Well, I had this question here, but let's talk about guitars. Are there any cool – I had the question, is there any cool or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of your basses? But let's say bass or guitar. I didn't know you played guitar at the time.
Oh, wow. Well, just – sure thing. I've been doing some luthier work. I've been building some basses.
Of course.
I have to say, I'll admit, I don't make the necks. The necks are a little beyond my skill and my garage workshop.
Sure.
Out there, but I've found some necks online and I've built the bodies and put the bodies together and routed for pickups and did electronics and
For guitar or bass?
I think I've built like six of them now. They're fun. And I've played them on some professional gigs too.
SVS line. Is that the name of it?
That's exactly SVS guitars. That's what I was going to
go. There you go, man.
That's how you would market it. There you go.
Absolutely.
I will tell one story. It's kind of, I don't know how much time we have, but
much as you want, man, we got plenty of time.
There's a bass. I was playing a Kenny Loggins gig, and I was in the market for. I wanted a 5-string fretless bass, and some guy came up to me and like threw a brochure at me. I make basses, man. You know, check it out. So I had the brochure and I threw it in a drawer. About a year later, I was cleaning out that drawer and I found the brochure and I went, I want to check this guy out. Maybe he can custom make me a 5-string fretless bass. So I went to his place, which was a 2-bedroom apartment. He's making basses out of an apartment building. I don't know, his neighbors must have hated him with the saw and everything. So,
and you know that thing is going on at night after his job, his day job finishes. Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. And, he's like, and the paint fumes, you know, I'm like, geez, what is this guy doing this? Anyway, I was talking to him about it. I wanted a 5-string fretless, and he's like, okay, well, we can make you one and everything. And I'm looking, and in the corner, leaning against the wall, is this 5-string fretless bass. And I'm like, well, what's that over there? And he goes, oh, that's one of my older models. That doesn't represent really what I'm doing anymore. You know, everything now, 6-bolt, that's 4-bolt. I said, can I try it? He goes, sure. So I pick it up, start playing it, not even playing it through an amp, and this thing is just singing. It's like, I'm going, oh my gosh. And I said, well, you got an amp, put it through. And he's trying to talk me out of it. He's saying, that's old. And see, I don't make that, you know, he's very, you know, personal about his creativity. So he's like, that's old. I don't do that anymore. It's like playing someone one of your songs, like, oh, this isn't mixed yet. You know, this is a rough mix. You know?
Right, right.
So I'm playing this thing, and I don't want to look too excited, but absolutely everything I've always wanted in a 5-string fretless bass.
Wow.
So I said, man, not to go through the song and dance, he says, but I'll, what do you want for this thing? He goes, you don't want that. I'm like, well, maybe just get this and maybe you'll make me something in the future. I said, but let me, long story short, I walked out the door with it for $750.
Holy crap. Wow.
And it is, okay, that's the first part of the story. Cut to, I'm playing with Christopher Cross in a casino in Reno. And the end of the show, the main money guy, he's like the money manager guy at the casino. So he's pretty big time. He's a guitar collector. And he goes, what's that bass you're playing there? And I said, it's a Hanawinkle fretless bass. He goes, would you like to sell it? And I said, it's not really for sale. He goes, I'll give you $5,000 for it.
That's it? If you could go $7,500, we could do the deal.
Well, it gets worse or better, however you want to look at it. Then he offers me $10,000. And I said, no, it's just not for sale. And he kept going up. He got to $25,000. And he was starting to get on my nerves. And he was just trying to this guy's got, you know.
Yeah, he's trying to show you how much money he's got at that point. Yeah.
And I just kept saying no, and I said no to $25,000. And I walked out of there, and my colleagues are going, you're out of your mind. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to let this guy beat me. Not to mention, I don't want to give up that instrument. That's right, most important, right? That's the most important thing. I don't want to get rid of that thing. Cut to, I run into a bass player a couple of years later, and he's got a 5-string fretless Hanawinkle bass, one of the new models that this guy's making. Craig, this was the worst piece of crap.
You're kidding me.
I couldn't, and I don't mean to, I hate to say that about this guy who makes good instruments. It was all wrong. It was one of the worst sounding fretless basses I've ever played.
So good job. So you didn't sell it for $25,000.
So here I am thinking, okay, had I sold the bass for $25,000, which probably would have spent it already, and I wouldn't have had anywhere near the great instrument. So that was a long story for.
Wow. For very cool story, man.
I still have it. It never leaves the house. It's my studio, recording studio, fretless bass, and it's I'm in love with that instrument. It's so wonderful.
Do you play mostly new gear or vintage?
Most of my stuff is new, but the fad today is to get relic looking basses and guitars made, and there's a couple of companies that do that. I'm with a company now out of Germany called Sandberg. Mm-hmm. They're phenomenal. I just got my first bass from the guy that owns the company there. Holger Stoniak is his name. And my gosh, these are most playable basses I've ever experienced. They're wonderful.
They make guitars also, or just?
They make guitars, but basses is his specialty. And he's a bass player himself, so he's got kind of a, you know, more of a love for that. But they make great guitars as well. But Sandberg, Sandberg, Sandberg Guitars. I can't say enough good things about them, and I'll be using three of them on the next Toto tour.
Wow! So three basses,
exclusively playing Sandberg for the next tour.
Are they trying to break into America? I'm assuming.
I'm sure. I mean, he's got a great. He's been around, I think, since the early '90s, or maybe even late '80s, '87, I think.
Oh wow!
he first started, he was a piano builder with a partner, and they started a company. They both loved bass, and they started making basses, the name of the street that they were on was Sandberg Avenue or something. So they just called the company Sandberg. And they're like I said, I can't say enough great things about them.
That's really cool, man. That's
great. If you go to shemworks.com, there's a picture of me on the front playing my new baby. Yep.
That's really cool, man. Yeah. I'm sure they're thrilled that you've got three basses on the road, that's all you'll be playing.
He's been very fair to me. Usually the waiting list is 8 months from the time you order one, and he's rushing two more to me before the start of the tour.
And if you're a bass player, I will sell you the spot for $25,000.
Yeah. Well, see, he's very consistent. His basses are very consistent. So if someone offered me $25 for one of his, I'd sell it and make me a new one.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Who are your biggest influences on you, bass and guitar playing wise?
Starting with bass, probably my favorite player is Gary Willis.
Who's he from?
Gary Willis, you know, there's a jazz fusion band with Scott Henderson called Tribal Tech. You heard of those guys?
I think I might have heard. I've never been a big jazz fusion guy, so I'm a little deficient in that area.
Scott's a jazz guitarist, solo artist, fusion. One of my favorite guitar players.
Yeah, he's awesome. I've heard of
and
Scott.
He was in the original incarnation of Chick Corea's Electric Band. Hmm. And Scott left the electric band and hooked up with Gary Willis, bass player, and they formed a band called Tribal Tech. And when I was talking about five-string fretless basses, he's the guy that inspired me. I think he took Jaco Pastorius to the next level.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think he took that Weather Report Jaco thing and made it his own, and he's just phenomenal. He's not just a great bass player. He's a phenomenal musician. I have nothing but respect for Gary Willis. Very cool. Always loved Marcus Miller. I've known Marcus since I was a teenager.
He's from New York, isn't he?
Yeah, my dad used to hire him a lot. We played together. I played drums with him playing bass on some of my dad's sessions.
Man, do you know a guy? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize. You played drums with him?
Yeah, a couple of commercial jingle sessions.
That's really cool. Do you know a guy, a drummer from New York, a black dude named Tony Lewis? He went to high school with Marcus at Music and Art.
Tony Lewis. It's not ringing a bell.
Okay, because I know he's been around the city for ages, and I know he used to do some work with Marcus, but Marcus probably played with everybody.
Yeah, he has, including Miles Davis. I also love Verdeen White from Earth, Wind & Fire. I love his playing. When I was really small, I loved Chris Squire from Yes.
Oh, man, what a monster of a player. Yeah, man. I saw them right before he died, about 6 months before he died, down here in Tampa, and he was just... And you know,
still playing great.
Oh, he's still playing great. And the guy's massive, too. I don't know how he stood for. I mean, he's just not necessarily overweight, but just a massive human being.
Oh, he was 6'5.
Yeah. I mean, he was
6'5.
Tremendous guy. And he just stood there all night, you know.
With ginormous hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huge hands. I shook his hand one time and my hand just like went into this void and it disappeared.
I believe it. Yeah. Oh, I totally believe it. As opposed to, and not to speak ill of the dead, but Walter Brecker, when I saw Steely Dan, man, he was the opposite. You know, he was not doing well at all.
Yeah.
You know, and you can tell, you know, it just didn't look good. So, and go figure. And this was about 5 years ago. So. Mm-hmm. But anyway, okay, so Chris Squire.
Yeah, there's a guy who not too many people have heard of, and I'm really happy to plug him. Is a guy named Terrence Palmer. There's a Christian gospel artist named Fred Hammond. Fred Hammond's one of my favorite artists, but who's also a bass player himself. Hmm. But Terrence Palmer is his live bass player, and my gosh, he's phenomenal. He just every song I hear him play, he does something in there just makes me do backflips.
Cool, man.
Yeah, he's great.
How about guitar-wise?
I mentioned Scott Henderson.
Yeah.
He's probably one of my favorites. Always loved Steve Lukather. I mean, who doesn't? John Scofield.
Sure.
Love his playing. There's a guy with a Canadian band called Saga, Ian Crichton. Mm-hmm. Ian Crichton I've always loved his approach. Kind of a wacky player, but I enjoyed his enjoyed his sound and his playing. I know there's guys I'm not thinking of on the spot here that I'm leaving out, but
so you're skewed towards the jazz side of things, jazz fusion side of things overall.
I wouldn't say that's my favorite kind of music either. I would, but you know, these guys, to play that kind of music, you got to be pretty kick ass.
Yeah.
And I appreciate what they do and then stand in awe of their musicianship. So I lean towards really appreciating that level of playing.
Sure. Well, again, that goes to the bar is high. So you're looking at, you know, you're very consistent with that, which is good. You know, you're everything that you're looking at, you're looking at through a high bar lens. Because all these guys you've mentioned I don't know all of them, but the ones I do know, they're all.
You got to throw Jeff Beck in there too.
He's an
iconic player, and probably one of the most individualistic players.
Yeah, he's amazing, isn't he?
Yeah,
and when you listen and look, and then you think on top of that, there's no pick involved here. It's almost inhuman. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how. Now I have two of his guitar players coming on this show, and I'm going to ask them. You know, what did you? You know, I don't even know the right question to ask them, because it's like, you know, how does Jeff Beck do that? I mean, that's not the right question. I don't even know. But what is it like watching? I don't even know. I have to figure out the question. But I've got two of his guitar players, so I'm interested in hearing some of them.
Lukather tells a story that when they were doing some sort of festival playing, and he and Steve Ferris, who was the guitar player in Mr. were standing watching Beck play after they had just played their set. And Beck just like held this note, this one note, for like a good, 18 seconds or whatever, and just held it with like so much soul. And Steve Lukather is a pretty notey guy. He said to Ferris, he goes, Beck just said more in that one note than we both played together in our combined performances with one note. He said more than we did with that one note.
You know, and that's the art. That's, to me, that's the. The community, the emotional piece of this whole thing, man.
Yeah.
You know, someone could reach in and touch you with one note, man, that's powerful shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing like it.
You've been very open here. Are you outgoing or shy by nature?
I would say I've always been a pretty confident person. I'm confident as a communicator. I don't have a lot to hide, so I'm just kind of an open book, wearing my heart on my sleeve. I'm shy with certain things, though. I mean, I'm respectful.
Yeah.
So I think in my desire to be a respectful person, I can be shy or timid in certain situations just to kind of gauge.
Sure.
A situation, just so I'm entering it with respect.
Yeah, it's probably not timid. It's probably just like knowing when to be quiet and when to.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't consider you a timid guy, but I would.
You learn more by being quiet. Learn more.
Well, it's funny. My wife became a realtor a couple of years ago after, she wanted to go back to work because our kids are grown. And I said, you're going to do great. I said, just remember one thing. I said, you got two ears. And when you're in sales, I said, if you shut up and listen, you'll never want to, you'll always know how to service a particular client of yours, because they're going to tell you, just let them talk, And it's... It's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of them. What's your best childhood memory?
Best childhood memory. Wow. That's a...
Yeah, you got a big catalog there, man.
Some of my best childhood memories are growing up on that ranch house.
Really? That's cool.
And one of the things I miss most about my childhood is horses. I'm in love with horses. Horses make me cry. I love them so much. I'll see them on TV and just see their majesty, and I just go crazy.
Yeah.
I love them. My wife and I watch the Virginian, reruns of the Virginian.
The cowboy show.
Yeah. One of my closest friends is the son of the guy that played the Virginian. Timothy Drury. He's right. a keyboard player in Don Felder.
I know. He's coming on the show.
It is. Oh, good. And his dad was the Virginian, so you'll have to definitely talk to him about that. So anyway, we'll just watch that show and the horses will be doing their thing. I just love it.
That's
it. I miss the, like I said, the smells and the, and their power, and they're very smart. They each have their own personalities, you know. I miss that. I'd like to be in possession of that again someday.
Can you get horses where you're at now, or like you have to get?
If you're going to do that, you have to get property for that.
You need a lot of space, I would imagine.
Or you house them somewhere out that on a property and go visit them and ride them.
That's kind of takes away from the joy of what you're looking for. You want to wake up and go out back and stroke them, get on them or whatever. Yeah. You don't want to go visit them somewhere else with someone else is doing all the stuff you want to do. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's your retirement plan now, Shin. We got it mapped out.
that's a goal. That's an expensive undertaking.
Horses and boats, man. They're expensive hobbies for sure.
Yeah.
Something or someone you miss from your childhood.
Ooh. There's friends of mine, best friends, guys that I grew up with, that I don't get to see as much.
This is in Jersey or Phoenix?
It was in Jersey. Yeah. But I run into them. I've been able to reconnect with some of them, and with my touring schedule, if I'm ever coming through their town, I'll hook up with them. But I miss, you know, the daily hang like I used to have when I was younger.
Yeah, it's hard to reestablish. It's hard to have that because you got this horrible thing as an adult called responsibility. And it seems to get in the way of that kind of carefree stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Or it limits it, you know, and it's hard unless you happen to have like the 1 in 30 guys that has like a close friend around the corner or something like that, that didn't move away, you know, that stayed in their home, or that somehow you connected with, but it's hard to connect at that level unless you have the time to commit to it, you know?
Yeah. And when a person like that knows you from that period and knows that the roots and the guts of who you were as you were forming your own personality and your own identity, it's great to be able to connect with that person who knows you that deeply
for sure,
and for that long. And at that period when it was so, you know, so innocent, like you said.
Yeah, that innocence for sure, man. Tell me something about yourself people will be surprised to hear or will find a little odd. Besides that you like play everything and if something needs to be done, you'll make it, grow it, pet it, whatever.
Well, I think you talk about regrets, you know, what's your biggest regret? I didn't serve in the military and I regret that very much.
Why is that?
I have incredible respect for those guys. I think what they dedicated themselves to, most of them usually at a very incredibly young age before they're really developed as men and women. I just have a ton of respect for that commitment, that dedication, what they're signing up for. And as far as, you know, my life got in the way and I wasn't able to do that. But I regret that very much. And I don't know if people would probably be surprised to hear that. But that's a big passion of mine. And I've always tried to stay close to what do I mean? I'm always just very aware of that, of the military and the different facets of it. And I enjoy the discipline. We talked about discipline before. I like the discipline. I like the structure. I like the thought of the sergeant screaming in your face, you know, 2 inches from your nose, and you just wanting to do everything that they're saying. I like that.
You like structure and discipline. You like structure. Yeah.
And I like the challenge of living up to a standard that they are setting. And
the high bar, man.
That's very attractive to me.
Yeah.
Plus the defense side of it. I'm very into self-defense and both physical hand-to-hand self-defense and weapons.
Do you take self-defense courses or have
I do. Yeah. I box. And I also I take Russian martial arts, which is called Sistema.
Wow.
It's a
I've seen videos of that. It is badass, man.
It is heavy duty stuff, but it's a way of life more than it's anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I use the tools from that walking through airports. Just how to traverse a crowd that's moving, not in any kind of lane movement. I love it. My breathing, how I recover from exercise or kind of physical exertion, I can recover very quickly because of special breathing techniques, and how to deal with pain. You know, stubbing your toe on the couch, how to make that pain go away quickly. Different things like that.
S-Y-S-T-E-M-A?
It's the word system with an A at the end.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Systema. Russian martial art. .com If you want to check it out, you can also find a local place in your area. There's different instructors, and they have to be certified instructors with the headmaster up in Toronto, Canada, former Russian Spetsnaz.
So what would you say the happiest moment or time in your life is or was?
The carefree growing up on the ranch in Idaho.
In Idaho.
Those are some of my happiest childhood memories.
Man, you're sucking me into that. You've painted such a good picture of it. I feel like I've gone back to Idaho with you. This is that's good, man. I'm glad you got that.
Yeah, I got, and it was a very loving, very relaxed time. You know, weren't a lot of distractions. And my parents were able to really focus on being parents, and I was fortunate.
It's great, man. Most important person in your life?
I mean, over a 52-year stretch, probably no one's been a bigger influence than my dad. And not just musically. He brought a lot of stuff into the house he brought a lot of media into the house. Like he had the first Betamax that ever came out, you know, before VHS tape was around.
Sure.
So in 1975, we had a Betamax in the house. And that's, you know, so I'm 10 at the time. And he's turned us all into comedy snobs.
<That's>
because
good.
We all grew up with, like, you know, the American originals like the Marx Brothers and Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and W.C. Fields. You know, those are the things that my dad brought into the house. And so not just musical influence, but just move the type of movies my parents liked and the type of entertainment. You know, he brought these things into the house for us and shared with all us. And I'm very, very fortunate about that.
Are your parents still around?
Yes, they are.
That's great, man. And they're living in Jersey still?
My mom's in Texas and my dad is in Nevada.
That's great, man. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Shem, what's your non-musical superpower?
I listen. My ears. And I guess you could say, you know, ears obviously help with music too, but I feel like I'm a good listener. I hear my awareness.
I was going to say, you're talking about awareness, yeah.
Yeah. Awareness of, you know, like a panoramic awareness.
Where'd you get that? Or why did you, was that intentionally developed or?
I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say it was intentionally developed. I think it just, I mean, I keep bringing up the farm or you know, the ranch, but you got a bunch of beasts running around that are like five times your size and they're, you know, running around. You got to be aware of what's your surroundings, you know, walking down the streets of New York City back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had to have an awareness. And I was taught that. My dad was, you know, when he'd take me to these places, he always was like, you know, keep your eyes open. Just, you know, you don't have to be paranoid. But so, yeah, I would say a acute awareness of my surroundings.
Yeah, that's a very important superpower. Best thing that ever happened to you, man? Growing up on that farm?
We're just going to default to
no,
that.
No, sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But I'm like, you know, I meant it enthusiastically, not like sarcastically.
Best thing that ever happened to me? Meeting my wife.
Very cool. You're going to get brownie points for that when she hears this.
As a grown man, yeah.
Biggest business or personal win?
I talked about the gratification of being included in a fraternity like Toto. That's just a feel good thing for me. Wanting to be able to play with those guys in that fraternity and knowing I had the capability, but just never thinking I'd ever get the opportunity. And then it happened. It's just, it's like pinching yourself every day kind of stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have any time? I don't know if you have any time for this. Do you have hobbies or interests outside of music? It seems like you have a lot of stuff that's kind of.
I make films. There's actually a page on my website of some film documentaries that I've done. We talked about my martial arts stuff. I love that. And just physical exercise and I love being outdoors.
Hmm.
Which in Phoenix is hard during the summertime because it's, 155 degrees.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, how come you're in Phoenix?
My wife, she's been here since 82. She grew up in South Dakota and she's lived here since 82. And I wanted to get a place outside of L.A.
Hmm. Yeah, I can understand
and,
that.
And when we first got together, she was actually going to uproot her life and be in Los Angeles to be with me. And I said, don't do that. I said, I'll come to you. If I hate it, we'll figure something out. And that's great. But who knows where we'll go. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily have to be here.
Sure.
The whole time.
Sure. Favorite place you've traveled, man. You've been all over the world.
Favorite place. Well, my wife and I actually love Vienna, Austria.
Really?
That's one of our favorite places, but I was able to be a place called the Faroe Islands.
F-A-R-O?
Yes. Yes. R-O-E.
Where Faroe is Islands. That?
That is the halfway point between Norway and Iceland. And is it the North Sea? Is that up there?
I think so.
It's 18 small islands.
I'm from the Bronx. I know, like Atlantic, Pacific.
Yeah.
Come on, you're pushing me here. Is that the North Sea?
we just went there. We did a Scandinavian tour, and we finished there. And it's just this little pocket of 18 small islands that I hadn't really known about, and it's just gorgeous.
Really?
Think of like the Scottish Highlands, and some of like those higher areas in Ireland. Just waterfalls coming down from the cliffs, and it's just so green, and there's wild horses running around.
It's
just phenomenal. What we learned that the first original settlers there were Irish monks.
That's interesting.
They speak their own language, Faroese. I mean, it's really.
So people live there, or I mean,
it's I think Denmark is the. Is the ownership of the island, but they're their own independent. It's like the Puerto Rico is to us.
Mm, got it. Interesting. Faroe Island, F-A-R-E. Cool.
Yeah, that was a special place.
If heaven exists, what do you want to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Great job, but now the challenge starts.
Toughest decision you ever had to make, Shem, or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
Oh, man, I should have.
Yeah, that's a tough question.
Say that again, the biggest decision or the hardest decision?
Toughest decision you ever had to make or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
I don't know if I can. I'm sure something will come to me when we're off the air here, but
it's all good, man.
Yeah. That's tough. Because I know there's one out there and it's just not coming to mind.
It's all right. Two more questions, man. And I appreciate all your time and you're being so open and it's just awesome.
Cool.
You've probably have been given loads of good advice. Is there a best advice or some of the one of the wisest things that you know you might have been given advice wise, and who gave that to you?
A couple of pieces of advice. Don't be in a hurry. That sounds simple, but if you apply that to everything from like, just apply it to everything. Don't be in a hurry. There's time. You know, you can, I'm not saying be lazy, that kind of thing, but, but just don't be in a hurry to respond.
To react too, man.
That's
been a big thing.
Yeah.
I read a book one time about disciplining your kids, right? And I'm always been a believer of natural consequences. Like if you screw something up, the best discipline is allow you to suffer whatever consequence that is, right?
That's right. My dad ever said, if you ever wound up in jail, I'm not coming to get you. You're going to spend the night.
Right. And that's fair because you know right from wrong. And unless somebody planted the drugs on you or whatever the hell it was, you know, that's on you, buddy. But we had three little kids, at this, you know, not little, it was, let's say they're my oldest two are 2 years apart and my daughter's 8 years behind that. So we had at one time, let's say a 15, a 13 and a three. And it was like, you know, a lot of work and madhouse, you know, and, I read a book on discipline and the thing they said in there, and it was like a 1,000,000 pound weight lifted off me. They said, you know, you don't have to discipline the kids right away. And I'm like, fuck, that makes so, yeah. I was like so relieved because like, you know, if they stress you out, you're not going to think clearly for any of you. You're going to, you know, at least with me, I'll probably put too hard of a, you know, like, I don't know. They put eggs in the VHS, you know, no TV for 6 years, you know, that's probably not the right decision, right? Or something like that, you know, you get what I'm saying. And then it's like too much pressure on me. And I read that, I was like, oh my God. And then I like started applying that to every area of my life. It was like, wow, life is so much less stressful when you don't do what you just said. You don't be in a hurry.
Don't be in a hurry. Yeah. And so we can all work on that. And here's another piece of advice I would give people. And in this day and age, it's really hard with social media and everything, but just respect your own privacy.
Yeah.
Your own, everybody's respect other people's privacy. How about respecting your own privacy? I mean, we have our constitution is set up where we're supposed to be able to, it's supposed to be protected. Well, everyone's giving up their information. Everybody's telling everybody how they feel about everything. How about keeping it to yourself? I think you empower yourself and those around you if you just shut up a little bit. Hmm. You don't have to tell everybody what you had for dinner last week. You don't have to take pictures of your food and share it for 300 friends to see.
Nobody gives a shit about your fish tacos.
Yeah. Nobody really cares. And I think I think if we could culturally learn to just kind of go dark for a while and reset, I think we would improve as a culture.
You know, and I think it was 2009, I gave a seminar. I published a book that year and I did a marketing seminar. And this is social media, which is starting. And I had a little thing on social media, not big. And I just said, the only thing I said was, I believe it's my opinion that social media is so popular because people are dying to be heard.
Relevant.
Because someone or somewhere will say, oh, I had fish tacos for dinner. And somebody else somewhere will say, where'd you get them? What kind of fish? And I was actually kind of sad because I think if people didn't have that need to be heard, that, you know, so they either need to, you know, figure out a way to nourish their own, you know, whatever is making you feel empty, or find someone that you can be heard with, you know, in a healthy situation.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of, like my wife has a lot of friends, not a lot. She's got a couple of friends that are always on Facebook, and I know they're not like particularly happy in their lives and they feel a little empty. And I think that's the void it fills for a lot of people.
It does. It does. And I think it's, and these social media is actually being used against us. Because you said there's people that have a void to fill, have a need to fill. They want to feel heard. They want to feel relevant. They right. want to feel like somebody cares or is mad or is paying attention.
Right.
And, you know, somebody clicks like under something they posted. Ooh, that's, you know, validation. But I was reading or hearing about something where there's been these studies that there's some sort of cycle where there's it inspires a depression.
Was that on NPR? Because I heard a thing on
could have been. It's like it's like a depressant drug, mm-hmm. whatever that thing is. I wish I had the verbiage right, but it's actually unhealthy emotionally because you get a high from seeing the response, and then
a letdown.
The come down from that exactly is.
Now I got to put up something. I get 5 more likes.
It's addicting. I just think if people could find it in themselves to go dark for just, you know, 6 months and just, hey, you don't need to let anybody know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Keep your privacy. It's one of the most empowering, powerful things that a free human being can have is just protecting what's theirs. You don't have to tell everybody your business all the time.
I hear you, man.
We used to be like that. I mean, we used to always raise in a house where, you know, where don't tell anybody how much money you make or who you voted for.
Right.
Just keep it to yourself.
Now,
there's a reason we go in the voting booth and, you know, slide the curtain behind us because it's a private moment.
Now you know, people don't shut up about either.
Now it's just everybody's just got their opinion and it's just like really dividing us, man.
Yeah, it is dividing. It's unfortunate. And what's really funny is do you think someone's going to read your diatribe about whatever and say, oh, you know, that guy's right. I got to change my voting policy.
you're not going to convince anybody.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's just venting.
Yeah. I'm going to start a campaign with buttons and pens and just say, go dark.
No, man. Shem for president 2000. And
God.
Whatever that is.
No, that's not me. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I'm too honest. I wouldn't be able to answer questions politically proper.
You mean like avoid the answer?
Correct.
Last question, man. And it's really been a pleasure spending time with you. I genuinely mean that.
Yeah, Craig.
What's your definition of happiness?
Being able to do what you want to do when you get up that day. I don't think happiness or success comes from wealth. I think it's loving what you do. If you love what you do, you know, it's kind of a build it and they will come thing. Happiness is being at peace, being who you are. I think being a good citizen, good person, brings you happiness. As long as it's not artificial.
Yeah.
I'm going to give to this charity because it makes me feel good. No, if you can find it in you to just be genuine, honest with yourself, I think that breeds happiness.
I hear you, man.
That inspires happiness. Happiness has to be from within. If you're not, it's going to be tough to buy it.
You can find it on social media, apparently.
For a minute until you get
Farmville.
Come off it. Yeah, right.
Hey, listen, man, I cannot thank you enough for your time. Honestly, you're like a breath of fresh air. I mean, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And
likewise, Greg. Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course, man. First of all, as far as like you being around, I just want to tell people where they could find you. If Toto comes to your town, you know, buy tickets, come out and see Shem. He's an amazing bass player and guitarist and drummer and singer. And he's just got a really good work ethic. And I think from what I know of you, you're giving 110%, which is more important than any of that. So here's resources to find Shem online. First of all, his website is called ShemWorks, ShemWorks.com. His full name is Shem Von Schreck. And you can find him on Twitter. I'll spell his name. It's Shem, ShemVonSchreck. All right, Shem Von Schreck. And it's the same thing on YouTube, and I'll spell that one more time. ShemVonSchreck. And it means jack of all trades with anything to do with music. So check him out online. Buy his stuff. Send him money. Check out his project with Steve DeSantislaw called The Apex. He's got a page of that. Steve is David Gilmour's drummer. He's got a tab on his webpage where you could check that out, and you can go check him out on iTunes, and I'm assuming any other place music is. Right? Okay, yep, that's called The Apex. And that's it, man. Go spend money on Shem stuff. Come see him and see him with Toto when he's in your town. And, man, I appreciate your time again. Honestly, thank you so much. You're awesome. I'm glad we got to
meet. My pleasure, Craig. Absolutely my pleasure.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I'm going to stop calling it interview, this conversation. I feel like mechanical. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And thanks again to Shem Von Schreck for spending all the time with us. I really appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future podcasting shows, along with some cool stuff we'll be doing for guitar players. Now, be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. And I am out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.